dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, three determinedly independent journalists talk about Iraq and the state of truth-telling about the nature and actions of the American Empire. Stay tuned. On March 24th, renowned investigative journalist Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker spoke at Ithaca College. If you were one of the people unable to attend the talk or hear the live broadcast on the Ithaca College station WICB, they very kindly provided a copy for us. The Dean of the Park School of Communications at Ithaca College introduces the speaker.
Seymour Hersh is with us tonight as our second Park Distinguished Speaker. The series, established in 2004 by the Park Foundation, allows the Roy H. Park School of Communication and Ithaca College to bring to Ithaca the nation's most important thinkers and social critics. I'm Diane Lynch. I'm the Dean of the Roy H. Park School of Communications. I would like to thank April Corpy and Melissa Gattin, who are the two women who are the action and the power and the skill and the intelligence behind making something like this happen, and they don't get enough credit. And I get the applause, and they do the work, so can we thank you. Wherever they are. Thank you. So I would also actually like to ask you to join me tonight in thanking our sponsors and our benefactors, Mrs. Dorothy Park and her daughter Adelaide Gomer, as well as the Park Foundation, for their continued support of and contributions to the intellectual engagement and civic responsibility of our community, not just on campus, but in the city as a whole. Absolutely. I went to college just after the Watergate era. It was a time when Americans believed in the power of the press to protect and defend the public interest and the public good. It was also a time when some of us dreamt of growing up to be journalists. I wanted to grow up to be him, because journalists were counted among the nation's heroes. We have come a long way since that more idealistic time. The internet has changed the way we access and absorb information. Five major corporations control most of the media industry. And journalism itself has suffered from a slate of public humiliations, from Philip Glass to Jason Blair, and public opinion about its credibility is at an all-time low. Journalists don't even rank up there with, like, insurance salesmen. And yet, we still have the exceptions that, in fact, prove the rule, but that also offer us inspiration and hope. One of those exceptions is our speaker here tonight. Seymour Hersh, Cy, if you know him, or even if you don't, is a legend in American journalism in his own time. He has uncovered some of the most important stories of the past 40 years. They include the massacre at My Lai during the Vietnam War, the CIA's bombing of Cambodia, Henry Kissinger's wiretapping, the CIA's efforts against Chile's Salvador Allende, and most recently, the abuse of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. He is the author of 8 books, including The Price of Power, Kissinger in the Nixon White House, The Dark Side of Camelot, and most recently, Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. He has won virtually all of the major professional awards anybody gives anybody, including the Pulitzer Prize, the National Magazine Award, and the George Polk Award, and he has just been announced, it's just been announced that he received his 5th of those. Seymour Hersh is without question the country's most provocative, controversial, and hardworking journalist. He is as often the subject of headlines as he is the writer of them. He is an objective reporter and an informed and insightful social critic. His work and his worldview will always challenge us to think about what we assume, about what we know, and about what our government does and doesn't do in the name of the public trust. Hearst says his mission is, quote, to hold the people in public office to the highest possible standard of decency and honesty. To tolerate anything less, he says, even in the name of national security, is wrong. Pentagon advisor Richard Perle has called Hirsch the closest thing we have to a terrorist. Please join me in welcoming my favorite American terrorist, Seymour Hersh.
It's a Bush bash, huh? Unfortunately, well, you know, we got to deal with the reality. I'm going to tell you a little bit what's on my mind and do a lot of questions because that's fun for everybody, I think, including me. But I'll tell you where we're at. It's sort of a strange place. Here's the situation. Yeah, I think I'm virtuous. I have the white hat. I do these things. I win these prizes. I'm conducting things in, with what I see as the utmost of honor and integrity. But we have a president who absolutely believes that what he's doing is equally as virtuous. He believes he has the white hat. He believes he's doing exactly the right thing. He believes. Well, you know, we'll do questions. I take it as a question. Anyway, he believes, the reality is still, he believes he is perfectly serene in what's going on. In other words, what I'm trying to tell you is he's not reachable by me or my colleagues at the New York Times or the NBC or CBS. We can't reach him. Because he thinks that he's going to be judged. He's got 1,500 plus body bags. I wouldn't presume to say that anybody wants more deaths. I can't begin to imagine he does. But if another 1,000 or 2,000 American body bags come back, it's okay because he sees himself in the middle of some, you could call it a crusade. I have no idea what's in his mind, whether he's doing it for his father, whether he's doing it out of a religious conviction. He believes that it is his mission to bring democracy to the Middle East. He defines the Middle East as Iran, Iraq, Syria, now what they call in the White House, occupied Lebanon. That's his definition. But he believes this. This is not some con act. He thinks that, okay, if it doesn't go well in Iraq, if it's going to take 5 more years or 10 years, he'll be judged on what happens in the long run. If it's 50 more years, they'll view him as the man who changed the world, who took advantage of the opportunity because of the fact that he was elected and reelected after beginning the war and reelected. He calls the second election sort of an accountability. People have always said, he's been asked publicly, the Washington Post in an amazing interview before his second inaugural, raised questions about the fact that all the people that made so many errors and so many misjudgments in the Gulf War, in the first war, that is the war against Iraq that he began in 2003, all those horrible mistakes that we see played out every day. And Condi Rice is promoted, Wolfowitz is now promoted or staying in office, Rumsfeld, Cheney, everybody. And is there accountability? And he said, the president said, yes, there is. He said, the election, the American people voted me back. That's accountability. They passed judgment on me. So he's got a ticket to ride. He's got 3.5 now, 4 years more. And we, as I said, what's really, I don't mean to lay a big trip on you, but I don't think we can hold him. We can't do it. This is not Lyndon Johnson worried about the anti-war movement or Richard Nixon being terrified about not only about impeachment, but also about the things he was doing and also the anti-war movement. This guy is not affected by it. We have a different creature. We call it neoconservatism. I once had one of the people involved say to me, bragging, when they began the war and the basis of all those phony stories about WMD, he said, this is before it went bad, he said, someday people will understand how 8 or 9 people changed the course of America and the world. They see themselves as virtuous. Remember Shinseki? What I'm going to tell you is not literally necessarily true, but it has a point of view. Remember, General Shinseki is the guy that before the Gulf War, the Army Chief of Staff, Hawaiian, testified that it was going to take 200,000 troops or 250,000 troops to win the war at a time when everybody in the White House, the neocons, were saying, oh my God, it's going to be much less. And Wolfowitz and everybody got very angry, and the next thing you know, He was basically humiliated by Rumsfeld. He was a year before he was his term of office was due. They announced his replacement. You know, they basically just shoved him off the stage. And so it's easy to think that, oh, they were mad at him for telling the number. And what I always thought, somebody actually once involved said to me, you've really got to understand these guys. They weren't mad at Shinseki because he used a much bigger number than they ever wanted to suggest, a quarter million people, 300,000, which of course turned out to be right. Here's what they're thinking is, didn't he get it? Hadn't he gone to all those meetings with Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and their other, Douglas Feith, their other neocons, at the tank with the JCF, with the chairman, well, all the five service chiefs, the four service chiefs and the chairman of the JCS, hadn't he gone to all those meetings and listened to us explain how we can do it with 25,000 troops? This is going to be a laydown. We're going to go into Iraq. Saddam's going to give up. Democracy's going to flow like water from fountains in Iraq. It's going to spread across the country. The Iranians will have a revolution because of the democracy there. We'll have democracy in Iran, democracy in Syria. That's what they believed. And with Shinseki, by challenging it, it wasn't a question of numbers. It was a question, it's almost as if he'd been deprogrammed. Somehow they got into the cult and they were deprogramming him. He'd broken ranks in a way that nobody did. And so it's a way of thinking that we haven't had in public life with this much power and this much authority. We have it. And how it plays out, I don't have an optimistic scenario for you. I think they're dead set in doing what they're going to do. There are some realities. There's always what's going to happen in the war. The war is going very badly. You don't know it because this government has taken the notion of telling lies or propaganda or mistruths to its own people to a level that's never been told before. We've never had this kind of systematic distortion of the facts. How to describe some examples. Fallujah. Remember the invasion of Fallujah. We were told before Fallujah. Fallujah, for some of you don't remember, is the mic on? Are you there? If you don't, hey, for some reason, if you lose me, scream. Don't be passive. So I've gone halfway through speeches, and somebody finally said, none of us have heard you for 10 minutes. such is the power of cult, right? And so in Fallujah, which most people don't know, is very important historically. It's a town of 300,000 in the Badlands. We call it Sunni-dominated part, the four provinces of Iraq that are out of our control. That is not Shiite, not Kurdistan, they're old Baathists. And Fallujah was a country that when the Ottoman Empire broke up, 1920, 85 years ago, they held out the longest against the British. And they were sort of famed in Iraqi lore. There's a lot of nationalism in Iraq. This is like not a nationalism everywhere. And they held out, and not only that, in the Sunni religious world, some of its mosques and minarets were 800 years old, incredibly, enormously valued and respected. And so before the operation began, we went into Fallujah, we announced, there was all this talk in the press about how we were going to do urban bombing, we were going to be careful, we weren't going to systematically destroy it. Then the war took place. And this hellacious war in which we basically destroyed the city. Nobody gets there now because American correspondents, it's impossible to move around simply because to do so risks death. There's so much distrust of anything Western, particularly American, around the country, particularly in the Sunni populations. So in any case, I happen to have a friend. Let me tell you something also about our government. There are people in the FBI and the CIA and the military that care as much about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution as anybody here that really care, that are really devoted their life. I can't tell you why more people don't speak out. There's a lot of fear. I think the same thing we see in the American press corps, sort of a fear after 9/11, a fear looking like you're on the wrong side of the American Goliath. So guys on the inside maybe don't speak out as much as they do. And it plays out in another way, this notion. This war has some very curious sort of sociological stuff. For some of us who lived through the horrible Vietnam War, we were mad at the kids who fought that war. They came back, we were angry at them, we dissed them. They couldn't wear their uniform in public. They were spat upon, not literally sometimes, but certainly figuratively. There's no similar anger at the American boys and women, men and women doing the war now, even after Abu Ghraib, there's a sense, sort of a collective sense, and I don't quite know how it works, but it does work. There's a sense that everybody who's there is there not because they want to, because they have a president who's pushed them there, and they're as much victims as the people they have to sometimes kill. And as you know, we don't have any accounting of the civilian casualties. One British medical journal estimated five or six months ago it was at 100,000. Just no counting. We don't have an accounting. This government isn't interested in having an accounting. Anyway, Fallujah. So I've got this colonel buddy of mine who's a good guy who was given the assignment. One of his expertise is urban bombing, sort of an oxymoron. And so he was, so after 3 weeks after the war, I called him home on a Sunday because I better not call him at his office. And he obviously had caller ID. And so he picked it up and he said, "Welcome to Stalingrad," because we just took the place down, took it down. And so, okay, here's what's going on now. We're now doing the same thing at a town called Ramadi. It's another town. What have we learned? No reporters, no embedded journalists, no coverage, no talking. The way you hear about it is this way. The military command, which controls, there's absolutely no media presence anywhere outside of Baghdad. They can't get out. If they do, they're risking their life. Occasionally, you'll see deaths of Marines in a province, Anbar province. You'll see sometimes in a week, 15 or 20, the Marines are in there doing what they did in Fallujah. I would guess the game plan, our game plan now, is since we have no ability to get intelligence on this, on the insurgency or the resistance, and I'll talk about what that word means in a minute, the goal is we're just gonna take it down city by city in the four provinces that are we consider where we have enemies. The thinking is, we haven't had any intelligence at all in the inside, so the thinking is we want to make the people that are protecting the insurgents, or I want to call them resistance, we want to make the people in the Sunni provinces more afraid of us than of the local terrorists or insurgents. Insurgency bothers me because it suggests, the call what's going on now is an ongoing insurgency, suggests that we won the war. And there are some people resisting after it's won. And the New York Times the other day had the headline, "Rebels," as if everybody accepts this horrific government we call the Alawi government, this former murderer and Mukhabarat operator, secret police operator for Saddam, who's now our acting prime minister, who has no standing whatsoever. We call him the government. And they use the word rebel. The fact is, it's a real simple fact. And what I'm telling you isn't me. This is my friends in the intelligence community. This is what they've been saying for over a year with nobody listening. It's not an insurgency. What we're fighting against are the people we started the war against. We're fighting this with Baathist, Saddam. Most of them don't like Saddam anymore, but they still like their party, the Baathist party. They still think it's going to come back to win, the socialist party that ran Iraq since 68. We're fighting them. What did they do? They didn't fight the way we wanted them to. We wanted them to stand up and fight. They gave us Baghdad. They gave us the Sunni triangle. They moved away. They moved into small cells. They're fighting us at their pace and at their level. But that's very hard to grab around. It's also very frightening to think that we are really into something we don't know much about. And that's where we are. We're in the middle of something. Yes, I think there's a legitimate loyal resistance. There's also certainly at least 1,000 or so what we call jihadists, Salafis, Wahhabis, martyrs, wannabe martyrs, young kids who just want to run cars into things. But those are not from inside Iraq. Those are outsiders. That's not the Iraqi way. The Iraqis never been into suicide bombing. They're fighting us more with more and more sophistication. So we have this president somehow believes that if he can make the Middle East democratic, terrorism will end and wars will end, as if democracies somehow don't fight wars, which is really hard to explain since we started a war as a democracy in Iraq. And I always think, when I think about the president, keeps on making these statements about democracy will bring peace, it'll be an end to terrorism, it'll be an end to conflict. I keep on thinking, let's see, my government since World War II, how many wars? And one of the things, as much as I have ambivalence about Bill Clinton, I've always given him a great deal of credit because he was the first American president since World War II, listen to this, to actually bomb white people. Every war. Think about it. When he went into Yugoslavia, And Kosovo, that was, you know, they were, you know, before that we'd always gone against little brown people, little yellow people, Middle East. We could do that with impunity. Grenada, where a population of about 100,000 people, most of whom worked for as house cleaners in New York. You know, we went to war there. That was easy because they were little, you know, semi-brown. There's some dispute Indian blood there. It's a lot of debate in that part of the West Indies anyway. But basically, so we're into it. What don't we know? Well, I'll tell you a couple of things we know. Let's see. Bombing. We've been bombing a lot since Alawi became acting prime minister January 28th. I make the case, and I believe very fervently, my friends tell me inside, that the bombing has gone up, if not exponentially, certainly all of last fall went up enormously through the winter, went down maybe in the beginning of this year, is back up. We bomb. We bomb a lot. There's no Iraqi air defense. There's nobody stopping us. There's no embedded journalists at the air base in Doha where we fly out of, or I think it's the Harry Truman, the carrier we work out of. The Navy flies out of there, and maybe the Marines do some flying somewhere out of the Gulf. Bomb, 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 bam, bam, bam. We don't have any statistics on how many sorties or how much tonnage. We don't know whether it's stable, gone up. Nobody asks. I mean, the limits to what we can do in my profession, an Italian journalist gets shot up at a checkpoint. There's not even any calls for the American soldiers to be interviewed. Nobody, it's not even on the question that a normal reporter would go to the GIs. I'm sure there's some story, you know, probably panic and fear. Nobody's suggesting it's murder, but it'd be fascinating to hear their account, and any good reporter would want to. It's not even a suggestion. It's not even in the paper that the Army won't produce them. It's not even in the paper that they're not telling us statistics. I don't see any great calls about the bombing. Bombing worries me because bombing's very easy. It's an easy solution, and it's a very imperfect solution. Bombs never go where they're aimed. And, you know, there are people beneath the bombs. Another thing that sort of drives me a little wacky, the election, January 30th. Let's see, we had about 130 or 35,000 American troops. We probably have the untold, the hidden, sort of the secret army, of course, are the private guards, estimated, I can't tell you, 10 to 20,000, the people that work for various private companies. Many of them are former Army and Special Forces and Navy SEALs. Increasingly, by the way, people are bailing out of the special services and going to work. Blackwater's one of them, $1,200 a day to be a guard. So you have 130,000 American troops, everybody pulled on in duty. You have 15 or 20,000, some vague number of private armies. You have 130 or 40,000 Iraqi soldiers all called to monitor this election. Bush brings in all of the satellites, overhead coverage. What I'm telling you now is it's right. We moved a lot of the birds, our birds over Iraq, all of the predators that were operating in particularly in Afghanistan, where we're still hunting some of the real bad guys, some of the Taliban and the remnants of Al-Qaeda, if there is an Al-Qaeda. I don't even know if there is anymore, but that's another story. But we're hunting somebody in those mountains between Afghanistan and in Waziristan, they call it, in Pakistan. And everybody was locked down, all operations stopped because of the election. Nobody could campaign, nobody knew who they were voting for, there were slates, they were ordered in the case of the Shiites, there was a fatwa issued by Ayatollah Sistani, you must vote. Many women didn't vote anyway because their husbands wouldn't let them, but many did. No Sunnis voted. The Kurds voted as many times as they could, which is a lot. Normal. And so, if an election like that had taken place in the Cold War in Estonia, we would have laughed it out of the ballpark. We would have just said, oh, come on. But now we're being told this is sort of a new Pericles, a new age of democracy. And, the press, I don't know, I guess they have no choices. it's sort of like, I think of this Richard Pryor bit, Richard Pryor, the great African-American comedian. One of his great bits is, it wasn't original to him, I think, but he did it effectively. His wife's gone, he's home, doing his wife's best friend in their bed. She comes home early from work, starts screaming. He jumps up, pulls a sheet around him, and starts explaining, what you're seeing didn't happen. What you're seeing didn't happen. It's not happening. We weren't doing what you saw. Are you going to believe, he eventually says to her, are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? And so, this is what Bush has done to us. You're going to believe him about Iraq and what happens, or what we see and what we feel and what we know is going on. I talked to two foreign diplomats this morning in Washington. I had to see them about actually something else, and we started talking about what's going on in the Middle East. And one of them, very wise, not allies, but not unfriendly, just in the middle, this one of them said, you know, the thing about you guys is this, you know, you're 3,000 miles away from everything. You know, there's no, you know, who, you know, what threat do you have, really? You know, it's not like being in Western Europe where what's going on in Iraq is 3,000 miles closer. And not only that, you have a huge Muslim, angry Muslim population. Most of the Netherlands and Germany and France, there's huge, growing, increasingly antagonistic problems because of the war and the ongoing mistreatment of Muslims by us. Is causing a lot of problems for Abu Ghraib would be another example, heightened tension. So he said, what is just in a nuisance to you, yes, it's money, some of your soldiers are getting killed, and there's some political problems in it, you know, and as you careen around making chaos, he said, in the Middle East. But what you don't realize is how intolerable it is for the people there. It's just intolerable. In Baghdad, no running water. No garbage, no electricity except sporadically, no mail, no phone, no civil society, and nothing vaguely connected to civil life, no security. I know somebody who's staying there. The Americans, this government always complains bitterly about Syria because so many Baathists have fled from Baghdad into Syria, which is absolutely true. The answer, of course, is millions have fled. They've gone all over. Anybody who could get out of there has gotten out to the UAE, elsewhere in the Gulf. Jordan is full of many more than in Syria, actually. Anybody's getting out. You can't live there. It's not livable. We've made it unlivable. I know a guy, a military guy, who was a senior Iraqi general who was missed by us, who worked a lot with the UN, so I got to know him way back. And so I stayed in touch once the war began, email opened up, and he has a daughter in med school there. And last winter he was telling me she has to leave by 1:30 because after that in winter when it gets dark early, you're kidnapped. It's just completely, I mean, you can't be in the street at 3-4 o'clock. And it takes a long time to get home. There's no public transportation to speak of. And roads are chaotic and often the Americans block things. I mean, it's hard to understand what the impact we've had. And it's, you know, it's hard for us in this nice warm auditorium. So let me see the time. I put my watch away. What do I do with it? Put it somewhere. Who's got the time? Here it is. 8:05. I'm going to do a chronology for you. 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock. Is that a play on the 5 o'clock follies in Vietnam? They used to have a briefing at 5 o'clock every day. And so what you have is, let me just do a chronology for you. Let me take it to Abu Ghraib and we'll move on. We can do questions about all these other issues, which are totally unresolvable. And I promise you, I know this is one big, huge downer. I promise I'm not secretly peddling uppers in the corner. I don't have, you know, I'm not doing it. It's just a downer. I don't know where to tell. I don't know how to tell you. There's some hopeful things we can talk about, maybe, politically, maybe. But not the Democrats. I mean, I sometimes think they're supine, and sometimes I think they're prone. But in either case, they're down in either case, and staying down. And a huge, shocking, frightening incapacity to lead that's increasingly terrifying, as these other guys show a great capacity to lead and mislead. Okay, so we go to the war. We go and we bang in, bam, bam, bam. We win the great victory. Baghdad's taken without any sweat. We don't really notice something. Yes, I'll tell you, the NSA, National Security Agency, is worried about it. On the night of April 7th and 8th, we entered Baghdad the 9th, the 3rd Marine Division, I think, or the 3rd Army ID, 3rd Army Unit came in. And they entered Baghdad and just took the city, the statue fell, all that. You know, we now know that was all propaganda, but that's okay. Statue did fall. It was a good television story. And by propaganda, I mean it was a park that could hold 10,000. There were 300 people there. Most of them were from Chalabi. Many of them were Pakistanis, paid by Chalabi to go there. And the Marines took it down. And then they got some kids to pose. And the whole thing was sort of, it didn't make, the feeling was good anyway when Saddam went. We were all, I mean, everybody said, okay, he did it. But they left the city. The estimate, the intelligence, the signals intelligence guys said they lost anywhere from 6 to 8, 9, 10,000 people disappeared overnight. And they included not just the guys that were going to do the door-to-door fighting for Saddam, his special guards, but he has something called the SSO, Special Security, and then there was the Special Republican Guards. He had thousands of those. But all of the guys who ran, the top bureaucratic guys who ran the post office, the hospitals, the power system, the water system, everything that makes the city work disappeared. And more than that, the looting that seemed to be so casual and random, remember all that looting? Rumsfeld made jokes about people breaking vases, who cares? Well, it wasn't so random and casual. Almost every major government office, not just the ones with the documents about state secrets, all the offices that included things like marriage records, property records, legal cases, files that were relevant to a city, everything that makes a city workable and a government workable were gone, shredded, burned. This was systematic. We figured out much later that one reason that the electricity power was crippled so quickly and we had so much trouble with water and so much trouble constantly with the oil, there are people in the resistance, Saddam's resistance, what they all did is they went to fight in the boonies. They went to fight in the people in resistance knew how to hit what where. They figured that out much earlier than the government figured out. The intelligence people knew that way earlier than they told us. They're beginning to talk more and more about it. But that was known in 2003. We got problems. So they go along. We won the war. There is some problem about the fact that there was nobody to fight us. And it seemed clear. That does make for a hard thing to get headlines out of that. But the embedded reporters did well. And you don't blame them. You know, it's all, everybody know the Stockholm syndrome, if you're an embedded reporter, the guys you're with every day do something dumb, which soldiers do all the time. Is there anything dumber than a 20-year-old kid with a weapon in a war zone? You're not going to talk about it. You're not going to talk about it because you want to stay with those guys. It's absolutely, it was a brilliant stroke by some of the PR people who work for the Bush administration who are, if not anything, very competent. And so we thought we won. Comes this by spring, summer, May, June, increasing activity against our boys. And not only that, increasingly sophisticated traps. Our guys are getting hit. There are operations being run where somebody's hit there, and then their escape route is already known in advance. It's clear there's some penetration even of what we're doing, how we operate. They're watching us. Somebody's learning about how the American troops react when they come under fire. Because they'll be put under fire and they'll react in a certain way that brings them into another trap. This was happening throughout the major provinces near Baghdad. In June, July, August, if you remember, of 2003, was really scary. The UN got blown up, a terrible casualty. A car bomb hit the Jordanian embassy, which inside Washington was scary because that's the embassy we use for all the down and dirty intel stuff. When the Israelis want to do something, that's an embassy they would work through. Because that's just the way the Jordanians have been, this sort of a middle ground for that kind of stuff. Water plants, the public could see the troubles with the UN, and you could see the public all in August of 2003, and of course the Jordanian embassy, but you couldn't see the systematic attack on waterworks and oil that was going on. It was the right places were hit at the right time. There were real dislocations. Panic in the White House, Karl Rove's involved. We got to do something. What do we have to do? Well, one thing we don't have is any intelligence. We know these guys are operating in groups of three, little cells. What we know, they even knew then, is Saddam had an opposition group called the Dawah. Dawah is a Shiite group out of Iran primarily. That was the only group that would take runs at Saddam and his family. When his son Erday was shot up, it was Dawah. They would make attempts on serious leadership. They were always being hunted down, and you could never break him. If you got a guy, he only knew about three guys. So Saddam, and what I'm telling you now is empirically known in our intelligence community from documents we captured and other stuff made available after the war. He set up three or four levels of covert action, and we couldn't break it. We couldn't find him. So in order to do it, what are we going to do? We've got 10, 20,000 prisoners in Iraq. Let's start squeezing them. We're not getting much out of them. Let's get more out of them. Let's start squeezing. Abu Ghraib was one of the prisons. So the idea is we start educating, start escalating the tactics against the prisoners. I can tell you right now, Human Rights, it was either Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International later estimated that at that time at least 90% of the people who were captive had nothing to do with anything. Many of the captives had been picked up in roadside blocks. The other thing we would do is if a car bomb went off and an American was killed, we'd either shoot at or arrest every male we could find in the area and just grab them, and they were automatically just bound, trussed up, and sent to Abu Ghraib for interrogation. And so this unit that photographs those infamous photographs that we saw, the 372nd Military Police Unit that was involved in all the hijinks at night at Abu Ghraib, you know, the stacking of bodies and that stuff, and the drawing on that the piece of literature, that horrible, iconic photograph. This was a unit from, a rural unit from mostly West Virginia. This was, I'm sure some of the people there were as bright as anybody, but they were very uneducated and very primitive by most. Lori England, I think, the one that was thumbs up and thumbs down. I think she, if I'm right, either she or one of the other women in the photographs, worked as a night manager for a pizza shop. So the Army Reserve is plans to get a chance to get a little money. It was a step up. So they're in the reserve. And they were MPs, military police, They were traffic cops. They had been trained to be traffic cops. They went to Baghdad to be traffic cops. At some point, they're pulled off the line and told, you're going to now be prison guards. They got some very rudimentary training, sent to a prison. It just so happens that in the Arab culture, the Arab world operates on we operate here, us lucky people, we deal with guilt, they deal with shame. Shame is very big in that society. And in the Quran, and this is literally correct, at least two specific mentions and many more indirect, it's against the Quran for a male man to be seen by others. It's just against by other men. It's just nudity is just absolutely a no-no. And it's also a taboo also in the Quran about homosexuality. Of course, it's practiced, but it's really a taboo in their society, at least in the religious aspects of it. And so the idea that you're going to suddenly take Arab men, strip them, have them simulate homosexual acts, photograph them with an American woman in the picture, that idea that generated from that unit is preposterous, because it's a very sophisticated, in fact, the use of sexual humiliation has been taught in down at Fort Bragg. It's in some of the textbooks down there as a technique, the way to break people. And there's another motive for it. I'll tell you, this is something I've written about, but I one of these days we'll find it out. One of the motives, of course, is we couldn't get anybody in the community. And once you have a photograph of an Arab man naked simulating homosexual activity, he's a dead man. He's gone in his community. He is shamed forever. You could take that picture to his community and he can't go back. So you can therefore take the picture to him and say, Sonny boy, we want to send you home. Go home, join the resistance, get active, and start talking to us, or else we're going to layer these pictures all over. That was another one of the intellectual drives. Of course, it was mangled and butchered, but that's one of the thoughts they had in setting up that crazy program. I was telling a group earlier, I think at dinner, that when I first learned about Abu Ghraib, it was much before it became public, but you couldn't, you know, Abu Ghraib was just known, Human Rights Watch and other people. You couldn't, the idea of writing a story before the photographs and saying Americans are mistreating somebody was just impossible. That's how bad it was stacked against truth, in other words. You just couldn't, the machine would grind you up. Not only the machine of the government, but your own peers. You know, I had one of my friends from Baghdad. I was in Damascus in December 2003, about 9 months after the war, and somebody told me then, an Iraqi, I was interviewing Iraqis who were coming out, they were into Baghdad, and they were coming out of Baghdad into Syria. And it's amazing, you know, you have to know borders are always open, always open. It's a world where you just, in any, even the most repressed place, borders just flow, can't stop border traffic. And in any case, one of the officers I talked with, a former Air Force general, one-star general in the signals intelligence, he said to me then about Abu Ghraib, how bad it was. He said that the woman, we had a separate wing for women that we would pick up at roadside blocks or when we went into homes and grabbed people. The women in the jail, mostly young, would send letters, messages home to their families saying, please come kill me, I've been defiled. And if you're an unmarried woman, just the fact that an American soldier has, you know, not, I'm not talking about rape, just fondled you or taken photographs of you or done something untoward, which young boys will do if they're unsupervised, was enough to say that their life was over, in effect. Please come kill me. I'd heard that. So anyway, so they begin squeezing the prisoners, okay, hijinks. What I'm telling you now is empirical. We know from the various investigations, there's been 10 since the first investigation, which is the only one, the first investigation, the one that I published in the New Yorker in May or April of last year, written by a young Filipino man who joined the army, worked his way up to be a major general, Taguba. Antonio Taguba was really stunned by what he saw, and he wrote a report that was never meant to be public. All the other reports have that one disadvantage, they were always going to be published. This guy nailed him. It's the best report yet, but of course, you know, time moves on. In any case, so by September, the games are on, photographing, parading people around, October, November, December. Meanwhile, who's going through the jail? Everybody. Three-star generals, two-star generals. They get a letter at one point in the early spring from Condoleezza Rice, I'm not kidding, praising them for their good work. Doesn't mean she knew anything, it just means everybody knew that was a hot spot. And they're just, the game's on, playing the game. How many people saw what was going on, knew what was going on? Are we talking hundreds, officers, thousands? How many? There was a constant flow of visitors because it was the biggest prison or most important prison. They really wanted to stop the insurgency, and they still were having trouble. The insurgency is growing, or the resistance is growing, and they can't find it anywhere. So in January, early January, a kid named Darby, there's always a kid named Darby in everything, a kid named Darby takes a videotape. Their kids are passing the photographs, no sense of any wrongdoing, no sense of shame. They're just photographing and emailing the stuff, CD-ROMs. He takes a CD-ROM to the Army cops, starts an investigation, criminal investigation division. The Army cops are upset. They're honorable guys, criminal investigation division. They're just old, they love to get officers. And so they started an investigation. We know the chronology, what I'm telling you now, is empirically known from the various Senate investigations and testimony by Rumsfeld and others. He goes in on the 13th. On the 16th, I think, Rumsfeld, of January 2004, on the 16th, Rumsfeld is told there's a problem. He tells the president 2 or 3 days later, by the 20th, let's say. He says, I never saw the pictures till they were made public, but I knew there were pictures. I knew they were bad. Why not? I have no reason to doubt him. You know, he's a very clever answerer. He gives answers that are very clever. You know, he's always restating questions that he doesn't want to answer, to my knowledge. I don't know about that. This one he said, no, I believe him. So what happens then? So the president knows about it. So the next thing we know is late April, CBS is messing with this story, and they won't publish it. They won't do it. And I pick up on it, and so the hell with them. I waited. I didn't care. I'm happy to have somebody else do the story. So I end up getting the photographs, and not more than that. The CBS had some photographs. I get more of the photographs, and I also get the report from somebody, people who really were troubled by it inside. I publish it in The New Yorker. What does the White House do? Oh, my God. It's all in the chronology. What's going on? The president assigns a new general to be in charge. They have new president says, I was against torture. I'm always against torture. Condoleezza Rice says, oh, my God. The president made it clear where we stand. And she actually literally says, I guess the army didn't get the message, she says to one group of reporters. So all goes on. What have they done in the 4 months between the time they're put on notice? Does the president immediately say to Rumsfeld, what's going on in there? This stuff is insane. We're fighting a war to win the hearts and minds of people, and you're doing this kind of junk? I want everybody on the carpet for this. Does he demand an investigation? Does anything happen except the prosecution begins of the low-level people who they want to bury? That's all that happened. It's all in. They did nothing. Ask about chain of command. Ask about what the president knew or didn't know. That's all you need to know is they did nothing. They wanted the little boys to get, and girls to get prosecuted, to enlist. That's where we are right now. No officer has been charged. And so there we are. That's the chronology. All of a sudden, there's gambling on the premises. To me, the chronology is beyond, it's devastating. It's an indictment in spades of the leadership. You don't have to say that they knew in advance. I don't think they did know. But once they did know, they did nothing. What does that tell you? We now know what was going on all over. I think when we're done, some of you know Civil War histories. When we're done, we're going to find that Andersonville, the famous prison, in what I think it was North Carolina, South Carolina, that the that was in the Civil War will equal, it'll be worse because they killed them, but in just many died in Andersonville. But in terms of contempt for prisoners, what happens, what's happened, well, as we find out more about Guantanamo, it's going to equal the worst sins of the prisons, both in Andersonville. And there was also a horrible prison up here. Yes, I've heard terrible stories, and that's not that I got into it. People tell me that some of the local townspeople would go and feed the Southerners because the North went. I've heard some amazing stories about that prison. But the stuff in Guantanamo, when you get it all, folks, you're going to be so appalled. And it's on videotape. They have a lot of it. What always struck me about it is after those stories came out, there was all this talk in the military about, well, there were rules and regulations. Rumsfeld said we could do this, and Ricardo Sanchez, the Army general in charge of the war in Iraq, said we could do this, and the Pentagon said we could do this. I spent a lot of time talking to people about this, and I'll tell you what I understood the rules to be. Do whatever you want. Don't kill them, but do whatever you want. Whatever you want. There were no rules. Of course there weren't any rules. It was just do what you can do. So we've been dealing macro. I'll take you micro, because you gotta get a sense of this, too. This isn't just all this macro stuff. So what I was talking about, the little guys getting killed, of course, I think about My Lai. And most of you students don't really remember. Why would you? You wouldn't know about it. When I was growing up, it's funny. When I was growing up in the 40s and early 50s in Chicago, World War I was way far off the screen. It was Ernest Hemingway and Fields, Flanders Fields and ambulances. And so for your generation, the Vietnam War is way sort of a distant, vague memory. But there was a time, and some of us have gone through it, you remember, you know, we survived it. There was a time when you'd wake up every day and you'd say, my country's raping, brutalizing, defoliating, and sodomizing and murdering a society today. You know, that's how many of us felt about the war. It just got hopeless. And it wasn't because of some, in my case, I covered the war for the Associated Press and I learned to hate it on the job just by seeing it. It wasn't because of any predilection to not like or dislike war. I was in the Army, didn't like it, but I learned that a lot of people, there are a lot of good people there, and a lot of bad people, just like there are everywhere. In any case, so one day in Vietnam, I'll just take a minute and tell you, there's an analogies. You see, in Vietnam, we didn't see the enemy. And there was a company called Charlie Company that had been sent to Vietnam in Christmas of 67, and by March of 68, they had never seen a soldier, a communist, North Vietnamese communist, or a Viet Cong. All they did was walk through fields and step on landmines and get shot at by snipers. Of the maybe 90 guys in the company, they lost about 12 or 13 or 14 dead, more wounded, in 3 months. And so there was this inevitable buildup of rage at an enemy you couldn't see. In Iraq, everybody wants to say it's so different. We don't see the enemy. There's no set pieces. All that happens is our guys drive around in trucks until they blow up. Then they jump off the trucks and shoot everybody they can shoot for a minute, and then we move on. Another day in the war. There's no set battles. It's very little of that stuff. And so in My Lai, one day in March 15th, the soldiers at Charlie Company, and they're part of a small task force, these kids, sort of like the kids we have today, on the underclass, kids who joined the Army because it was a chance, a lot of Hispanics now, just then, a lot of African Americans then, just now, it's a way to step up in the social ladder. And in this country right now, if you live in Guam or one of the countries that are protectorates of American, you can get a citizenship by joining the Army. So the Army's full of a lot of people who don't even know the language, really. That's absolutely true. There are a lot of guys in the armed forces because, as you know from reading recruitment stuff, who wants to go there? So they were told they were going to meet a North Vietnamese combat division, ready to kill, in a setup fight. This is it, guys. So they did what kids did then. They toked it up and smoked it up and drank it up and got ready and jumped on choppers at 4 in the morning and all juiced up, ran to the combat, guns held, terrified. 535, 40 women, children, and old men. It's about 6 in the morning. They're around the pots cooking their rice for morning in this village. And so for some inexplicable reason, but maybe it's not so inexplicable, but just what happens, as we know, this is the My Lai 4 story, the soldiers gathered them in the three large groups and began to shoot them, put them in groups and ditches and just began. And I ended up spending a year or so running around talking to people about it, kids in the unit. By the time I got to the story, it was the fall of 69. 18 months later, most of them were draftees and had come home. It's not like the Praetorian Guard you have now. We have a Praetorian Army. They stay in forever, which makes it harder to get stories in a way, obviously. So and one of the things I'm telling you is anecdotal. It could be not, you know, people take issue with it when I say it, but it's my experience, that most of the company, there was a disproportionate share of African-Americans and Puerto Ricans, Hispanics, naturally, because, as I say, underclass. Most of the kids who did the killing were the white kids. The African-Americans and Hispanics shot. They shot up, though, in the air. They didn't want to be caught not shooting, because in that war, that's a bullet in the back if you're not going along. That was a different war, a lot of what they called fragging. You didn't rat out your other guys. They shot, but they didn't shoot. And whether that's a wrong impression, I'm sure, you know, that every race can do anything it wants. But there was that was the experience I had. So anyway, they kill them all. And there's one remarkable couple things that you have to know about, because you have to understand. I mean, you don't have to understand, but I love sharing. Why should I have this? I'm going to pass it on to you. At one moment, they stopped and had a coffee break or a lunch break, meals ready to eat, C rations then. Amidst all this, they really stopped and had their lunch. And, you know, and a mother had tucked one of her babies in this ditch full of bodies. There were photographs later, just like there were photographs of Abu Ghraib. And they heard a noise, and some boy about two somehow had survived. She tucked the mother, tucked him under her stomach, and the onslaught had somehow missed him. And he got up and he crawled out of bodies full of blood, other people's blood, and he began to run across the paddy, or the walkway, or whatever it was there. And Callie, Lieutenant Callie, the infamous Callie, who's been targeted for all of his life as the main player, but there were three companies, five or six officers, but he was the one that was most articulate about it, I guess, in his own demented way. Callie said to this one of the soldiers, a bunch of them, kill him, plug him, and nobody could move. Somehow, something about the one boy. So he grabbed the rifle and ran and shot him and threw him in the ditch. Everybody remembered that. The next day, one of the kids who'd done much of the shooting, a guy named Paul Meadlow, had his foot blown off, stepped on a landmine. And the one thing that everybody, as I began to find, I was recreating this by finding kid from kid in the company, just running around the country. And at that time, I just had an American Express card. I just started American Express, and I keep on thinking, that's one ad you'll never see. Remember me? I solved the meal I story of my American Express. I had no money, but I had a card so I could fly around. Anyway, and so so Milo gets his foot blown off, and he's being medevaced. The kids all tell me this after an hour or so it comes out. He started shrieking, God has punished me, Callie, and he's going to punish you. It's one of those blood oaths that just somehow hung, whether you believe in such things or not. It was one of those chilling moments. So I went looking for Milo, and I finally found he lived in Indiana. Whatever you do, you find him. And I remember I was in Salt Lake City, and I jumped on a plane, went to Chicago, went down to Indianapolis, got a car. He lived in a place called New Goshen in the south of Indiana, which I knew. I remembered that part of the state because it was very heavy. KKK, Ku Klux Klan, ironically, it was as bad as down there as in Mississippi, really, at least in the last century, early part of the century. Not so bad later. And so I found him. I'd called the night before, and I got his mother. They were in a farm. And I said, told her what I was doing, and I said, I'm coming to see your son. She said, well, I don't know. I don't know if he'll talk to you. I said, well, I'm coming. She said, do what you want. I can't promise anything. So I came down there. And I drive up, and it's, some of you might remember Norman Rockwell. He used to do these little American paintings for the Saturday Evening Post 30 or 40 years ago, sort of everybody very square. And it was out of a Norman Rockwell painting. It was as poor as you could make it. It was a chicken farm. I didn't see any other crops, just some rows of chickens, no man around. She was by herself with her son, and some of the most weather-beaten wooden shacks that passed for the house, the home. So when I pull up, she comes out, and naturally she's weather-beaten. She looks 70, she's about 50, slight woman. And I say, I'm here to see your boy, where is he? And she says, of course I'm polite, introduce myself. She said, he's in there. And then I said, thank you. And as I start to walk, she says to me, quote unquote, she says, this rural woman, she said, I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer. So flash forward 35 years. I'm doing Abu Ghraib, and I did, I think, three stories in 3 weeks for The New Yorker. If any know anything about it, it's insane to do it, because they have all, not only the fact-checking, you have to go through the grammarian. Some of you, let me tell you, parallelism, folks? Come on. Comma faults? You got to get that. Anyway, it's taken very seriously. Parallelism is taken very, a lot of arguments about antecedents and a lot of witches and that's and a lot of I like to write a little I'm more newspapery anyway. So we have some testy times, but okay. So in the middle of all this, I do all these stories, and I'm trying. I'll just tell you what I'm doing. I know it goes to Rumsfeld because my buddies are telling me. I got buddies in there. I know what's going on. I mean, I know. I can't prove it all. I know it goes to the top. You know, you got a president that said after 9/11, what did he say? He said, you're either with us or against us. And he said, I'm going to drive Bin Laden out of his snake hole. And who's doing it for him? Rumsfeld. Anybody that thought Rumsfeld would ever get fired for any of this didn't understand how that team worked. They're in it all together. Who's going to get him out of the snake hole? Rumsfeld will. Is he going to do it legally? He's not doing it legally. He's operating without any authority all over the world. Even now, you know, they call it, the word they call it rendition. Rendition I describe as grabbing somebody by his hair and taking him to a part of the world where the sun don't shine, you never see him again. That's what they call a rendition. I call it taking somebody away to kill him. Okay? That's what happens, much more than you know. But I'm sure that would inflame some people. I mean, you know, because there's rendition. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, the Argentinians and the Brazilians, you know, we have nothing on them when it comes to doing disappearing people. And will we ever get a full accounting? No. I mean, nobody even wants one. You can't get the Congress to investigate it. So anyway, so I'm doing this stuff and I get a call from a woman. So I got to talk to you. I'll just make it a close relative, she says, another woman. I got a close relative who was in the unit that was at Abu Ghraib. And so this is the kind of stuff. This is what you call manna. You drop what you're doing. She lived in this part of the world, Northeast, very devout Catholic, had supported the war, I guess. The daughter was in a reserve unit that was also at that place, the 372nd. They'd sent everybody home. I have no idea whether this was to get them out of the way. Remember I told you that the report came in January. This young kid brought the photos in January of 2004. My stories are in May of 2004, and CBS also went public with the pictures, to their everlasting credit. Caused an enormous flurry, too, days before us. And in March, all of a sudden, all the kids in that unit were sent home. I'd like to tell you they were sent home to get them out of the way. It makes sense to me, but I don't know. I mean, most people were being extended forever, and they sent them home. So she showed up in March, the mother tells me, when I go to see her over lunch in some restaurant somewhere. The daughter comes home, and she's different, despondent, silent, angry, divorces, leaves her husband, doesn't divorce, and just walks away from a marriage, a young marriage. She's very young, early 20s, moves to another city, gets a night job, doesn't want to see anybody, inconsolable, unreachable, nobody knows what's going on. Abu Ghraib comes, the mother goes over to the apartment, knocks on the door, shows her, I guess, a New Yorker cover or whatever, one of the pictures, one of the stories, or maybe a newspaper story about it, and she slams the door. So at that point, the mother says to me that she remembered, she said there was no connection because she doesn't want to talk about the unconscious or maybe isn't aware of the unconscious. She says that she remembered at some point after the Abu Ghraib stories came out, that she'd given her daughter-in-law, or whatever the relation was, the woman, she'd given her a portable computer to take to war, because what they did in that war, which is really a good idea, they take a portable computer and they can play DVDs, they can watch movies and play games when they're in downtime. It makes sense to me. And so she'd given her one, and when the kid came back, she'd left it in the house and gone off. So she takes the computer and she opens it up. She said she was simply going to reclaim it. She hadn't used it in months. She's going to take it to her office, spare computer, and she did what people do. You erase it, clean it up, and there's a file marked Iraq, and she opened it up. As she's telling me this, just over a cheeseburger, out pops maybe 60 or 70 or 80 digital images of an Iraqi man, terrified, naked, standing in front of a jail cell, two huge German shepherds 3 feet away, the iconic picture that the New Yorker did run that ended up going all over the world. But the rest of the sequence was that she watched, we all saw, she saw, I mean, no mother should see this, the dogs attack the man at the groin, right below the groin, lots of blood, big pools of blood, no soundtrack, thank God.